What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Sylvia Jonas, Polonsky Postdoctoral Fellow at the Van Leer Institute and visiting researcher at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Her new book, Ineffability and Its Metaphysics, is just out from Palgrave Macmillan. There's a long history in philosophy and art and religion of claims about the ineffable, from the Tao of Lao Tzu to the One in Plotinus to Kant's noumena or thing in itself to Wittgenstein's famous remark at the end of the Tractatus, that whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. But even if the ineffable cannot, in some sense, be expressed, what can we say about what it is to be ineffable? What sorts of things are inexpressible, and what sense can be made of the claim that these things are inexpressible? In her new book, Jonas argues that there is no defensible sense in which there are ineffable objects, properties, propositions, or contents, but she does think that there are varieties of ineffable knowledge, and the core of these is the idea of a kind of knowledge based on acquaintance, and specifically self-acquaintance. Jonas's book brings together historical and contemporary claims about and concepts of the ineffable, and she provides a critique that will ground and inform philosophical discussion of the ineffable. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Sylvia Jonas. Are you there?
Hello, Carrie.
Hi.
Yes, I am here. Hi.
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for the invitation.
I'm looking forward to our conversation about your book, Ineffability and Its Metaphysics. It's a fascinating tour, you know, starting from a number of historical figures, from Lao Tzu to Plotinus to Kant to Wittgenstein and of course, many others, about the concept of the ineffable and what we, if even if there are things that we cannot, of which we cannot speak, maybe there's something we can still say about what it is that we can't speak, what it is to not to be able to speak about something. So before we get into the actual text of the book, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came to philosophy, and then how you came to write this book?
Well, that's actually an interesting question, at least to me. My first degree was in political science. And while studying political science, I discovered that what I found most interesting were the philosophical bits. So I went for a master's degree in St. Andrews to study philosophy. And there I discovered that within philosophy, what I find most fascinating are the theoretical bits. And throughout all this time, the topic of ineffability kept coming back. So I decided that I wanted to look into this topic, which has a very long and distinguished history in philosophy, using what's currently considered the best philosophical apparatus we have out there, which is analytical philosophy, and see if we can make any sense of the concept. Because up to today, I would say that most philosophers think that ineffability is not a topic that can be investigated philosophically, or at least not in any meaningful way. And this sort of hand-waving dismissal of ineffability as an interesting topic was something I found always a little bit disturbing. So I wanted to prove everyone wrong who thought that nothing meaningful could be said about the ineffable with the tools of analytic philosophy. So I went to Oxford to study with Adrian Moore, one of the experts on ineffable things, ineffable knowledge. And yes, I sharpened my tools there and then completed my PhD in Berlin and moved on to a postdoc here in Jerusalem, where I finished this book on ineffability and its metaphysics.
Very good. So just to start us off, the ineffable is, you might say, colloquially thought of as the unspeakable, or in some sense, perhaps ungraspable or unattainable, or it's a special kind of feeling that we can't express. Or what are some paradigm cases of the ineffable before we get into, I mean, you give a definition of the ineffable in a very precise sort of way, but just to give us a sense of what we're talking about, what are the paradigm cases of Yes. the ineffable?
So I think there are many different cases of ineffability, and one big distinction I make is between philosophically interesting ones and philosophically not so interesting ones. And so I'm going to give three examples for philosophically interesting cases of ineffability. So first example from art. I think that many people are familiar with the feeling of perceiving a specific work of art, for example, listening to a piece of music, to a specific symphony, or looking at a painting that they particularly like. And in some of those cases, when we have such an aesthetic experience, it phenomenally resembles a state of knowledge, which means that it feels like this piece of art has opened our eyes to something new. It feels like something was revealed to us or communicated to us, or we have gained some kind of deep insight. And usually that is accompanied by an exhilarating feeling. And I think many people know that. And I think that's why many people appreciate art. Something similar, I think, is happening in religious experiences. This is my second example. So not everyone is religious, of course, but those who are often report that in moments of prayer, for example, or in any other moments when they have a religious experience, it feels as though they just gained a new kind of understanding or an insight into, well, whatever it might be. And my third example comes from philosophy itself. For example, when we read, let's say, a piece of Wittgenstein's Tractatus, and we read, for example, about Wittgenstein's thought that the self has priority over the world, then this may open our eyes and make us look at the world in a completely different way. And this, the phenomenal character of this experience, is like a state of knowledge. It is like we gain a new and fresh understanding of something out there. But what connects all these examples is that whenever we ask a person, well, so what was it that you understood in this ineffable experience? Usually people answer, well, I cannot really put it into words. I cannot really put my finger on it. It's something like this and that, but not quite. So there is evidence that people have experiences that they find impossible to put into words. And my inquiry is about the question, how we can make sense of such experiences in terms of contemporary analytical metaphysics. Is there such a way at all?
Good. Good. That was very helpful. Let me just ask, I mean, the three examples you give and throughout the book, of course, are from philosophy, art, and religion. Are those the only areas of human, I don't know, existence or inquiry or social structure, what have you, where this sort of experience arises? Or are these just the paradigm cases? Are there, could it happen in science, for example, or sports, or something else?
That's a very good question. Yes, I definitely believe it could happen in other contexts as well. And indeed, some philosophers like Kant, for example, or also Adorno, describes experiences like that in, you know, just natural settings where there is no piece of art around and there is no religious context whatsoever. And so my answer to that would be, yes, I think it could also happen in science. But I think there is something about aesthetic and religious context and also to philosophical inquiry that sort of encourages experiences of that sort. And I think that has to do with the fact that in those contexts, we are encouraged, we are prompted to see the world around us with different eyes. We're confronted with completely extraordinary perceptual experiences, which may be a very fruitful environment for having extraordinary experiences, some of which might be ineffable. So I think there might be a connection between those specific contexts and the fact that, well, and the fact that such contexts encourage ineffable experiences. But I think nothing in my inquiry precludes somebody from having ineffable experiences in a different context.
Okay. So you start after dividing the important paradigm cases from a number of very trivial sorts of cases. You give a definition of ineffability, and you distinguish it from certain concepts that are kind of lurking nearby, indescribability and unknowability. So can you explain what for you is the ineffable, how you define it, and why that definition has the form it does?
Okay, so first I'm going to say a little bit about the two other concepts you just mentioned, indescribability and unknowability. Intuitively speaking, something that is ineffable might still be describable. For example, a stone is, by my definition, ineffable for a very trivial reason, because a stone is just not the kind of entity that could ever be expressed. But it makes perfect sense to say that we could describe a stone. And I think that, I think that's probably the best example for this. With unknowability, the distinction is that even if something is ineffable, it does not entail that we cannot know it. So something could be ineffable, and yet we could have some kind of knowledge of it. In fact, that is what I'm going to end up arguing for in the end, a specific kind of ineffable knowledge. So those are two distinctions that I think are worth making. And again, speaking intuitively, when I describe an object, then I can reveal parts of what characterizes this object. I can describe an object, I can give the properties this object instantiates. Whereas in a case of expression, for example, an expression of a proposition, the idea is that I'm communicating my knowledge fully to another person, whereas a description is always a partial matter. Now, would you like me to read out my definition of ineffability and then go through each clause?
Sure. I mean, you can also, that's fine. I mean, it's not that long.
It's not that long. It is a little bit technical, but perhaps it might be helpful. So I define ineffability as follows. A non-linguistic item Y is ineffable if and only if it is metaphysically impossible that there be a linguistic item X whose content non-trivially entails the content of Y and whose content is in principle communicable to other finite beings by users of a finite language. So I think perhaps the first thing that might be interesting to clarify is, why do I bring in the clause with finite beings? Well, I think that there is perhaps a way of saying that an infinite being might have completely different expressive resources and therefore be able to express all kinds of things that we are not able to express. For example, an infinite proposition. But I'm mostly interested in what human beings can achieve with the means of human language. So I'm not interested in infinite beings. I'm interested in human beings. The reason I add non-trivially is because, well, just logically speaking, for example, if we have a proposition that expresses the contradiction, then logically speaking, everything follows from it. And thereby, one could say that this contradiction expresses everything. And of course, that's not a meaningful way of talking about expression. Yes, and the reason I restrict my definition to metaphysical possibilities is because I think it is just the most interesting way of capturing what is interesting about ineffability. So I'm not only interested in what actual human beings, which are governed by actual physical laws, could achieve, but perhaps also what possible human beings in other possible worlds could achieve by the means of human language. So that explains the clause about metaphysical possibility.
Okay, so I mean the key term here though seems to be expressibility or lack thereof, and relatedly the idea of expressing a content. So could you say a word about expressibility, that particular and content as those terms play a role in your definition?
Right. So I think it is important before we talk about ineffability to have some kind of grasp of what we actually mean by expressibility. And an approximation would be to say that an item Y, a non-linguistic item Y, is expressible if and only if there exists some kind of X such that X expresses Y linguistically. And so the role of content here is that whatever a linguistic expression might be, it must be capable of sort of expressing the content of the non-linguistic item. So the content of the non-linguistic item has to follow from the linguistic item.
Okay. So let me just, in later chapters, I mean, after you kind of establish the conceptual background of your inquiry, you go on to argue that there's no good sense, and we'll discuss this, in which there are ineffable objects or propositions, and so forth. But earlier, you mentioned experiences, special insight, so special kinds of experiences that we have. And what I'm just wondering is, there's a sense in which your definition itself has an expressibility kind of something that can have content kind of built into it. So for example, an experience, whether it's ineffable or not, is the type of thing that, that you might say has a particular kind of content. You can give various accounts of that. But we have experiences of and their mental states and so forth. And then we sometimes use language to express these contents, or we can't, as the case may be. And so I guess the question is, your definition says a non-linguistic item is ineffable if and only if it's metaphysically impossible, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like to go back to your example before of the stone, which is, you know, describable but not, you know, it can't be expressed. It seems like you've already made it the case that no non-contentful item, let's put it that way, no item that does not have content can even be a candidate for ineffability. So almost by definition, an object like a stone or the one from Plotinus or something can't be ineffable because they're not the sorts of things that have content at
right,
all.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, no, I was just wondering if somebody were to say, or, you know, I mean, if, you know, Plotinus, you know, or somebody were to say, I'm talking about the one or talking about, you know, the absolute or some of the more, you know, metaphysically heavy items in the history of philosophy that have been said to be ineffable. Those items are not the kinds of items that have content like experiences.
Right.
And so they would want to say, I'm talking about this, you know, this divine thing or this reality that is ineffable, and you've given me a definition in which my item can't fit, not because it's not linguistic, which it isn't, but because it's not the kind of thing that could have any content to begin with, like an experience.
I see what you mean. Okay, so I think I'm going to save whatever I have to say about things like the one and ineffable objects for a later stage when we're going to discuss that. But I think the confusion here stems from the fact that you seem to be reading non-linguistic item as something like the one or something like a stone. Mm-hmm. In other words, as a concrete object, whereas I'm thinking of non-linguistic items as a broader category. So, for example, in let's say we have a successful case of expression, I have a linguistic item like a proposition, and the non-linguistic item would be a propositional attitude that I'm standing in towards that proposition.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, a belief. I think a belief is a typical non-linguistic item that is potentially convertible into propositional form and therefore linguistically expressible, but by itself not a linguistic item yet. So I think that probably makes it a little bit clearer.
Okay, so there still seems to be a kind of a built-in limitation to maybe mental states. I guess a cup is a non-linguistic item, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And a thought, you know, an experience, a propositional attitude is a non-linguistic item.
Yes.
So your definition specifies non-linguistic items, but I'm wondering if maybe it is more like a mental state is ineffable if and only if.
Mm. I suppose I would have to know exactly what you mean by a mental state. Well, I think perhaps it is a little bit confusing because something like a stone and something like a mental state mm-hmm. Come out as ineffable, according to my definition, for different reasons.
Okay.
So the concrete object, the stone, doesn't have any kind of content that could ever become part of our mental contents. That's how I set it up in my terminological chapter. Whereas the question I'm raising in the book, and according to which I also tailored my definition of ineffability, is whether there could be non-linguistic items more similar to beliefs or other propositional attitudes that, even though they're not concrete, cannot be brought into propositional form. So I think that's an important distinction between concrete objects on the one hand and, as you said, mental states on the other.
Okay, that was helpful. So maybe we should talk about the first category of ineffable items, the ineffable objects and properties that you talk about, I believe, in chapter 3, where this is probably a fairly well-populated category throughout the history of philosophy in terms of the sorts of things that are considered ineffable, mm-hmm. including many, you know, concrete, in some sense, concrete objects. At least they're not mental states. They're some sort of reality. So can you say a word about your analysis of these claims of ineffable objects and ineffable properties?
Yes, with pleasure. So in my chapter 3, I'm going through these historical examples that you just mentioned, and I'm looking at how philosophers have brought the concept of an ineffable object up. And in most of the cases, we find talk about an ineffable absolute, or the one as in Plotinus, or reality as a whole as in Kant's writings, or slightly more extravagant, the will as in Schopenhauer. Mm-hmm. So there seems to be this idea that if there is an ineffable object out there, it must be some kind of very distinguished object. And the suggestions are, well, it could be reality as a whole, or it could be God. And some philosophers identify these two, for example, Hegel. So we have this sort of all-encompassing object out there that is sometimes argued to be ineffable. So then what I try to do in that chapter is to look at possible ways of making sense of that claim, and specifically of making sense of the fact that even though we've just said a minute ago that the absolute is ineffable, we are right now talking about it, and specifically we're predicating a specific property of it, which is absoluteness. So how do these, how is that not contradictory what we're doing here? And so one way I think we can think about the absolute, I'm going to continue talking about the absolute, but I think it's the same as saying the world as a whole, or
right.
The one, or even Schopenhauer's will. Mm-hmm. So one way of thinking about the absolute is to say, okay, if it is supposed to be the object that encompasses everything there is about the world, then presumably it instantiates every property, which means that every predicate applies to it. But then, of course, for every predicate P, also its opposite applies to it, which means that we have contradictory predicates applying to the same object, which would then make it impossible to say anything meaningful about this object, because whenever we say P of this object, we also know that we could say non-P. So that doesn't make any sense. So I think this is one way of thinking about how we're not making a mistake in saying that the absolute is ineffable on the one hand, and yet calling it absolute on the other. So then I move on to thinking about, well, what kind of property could this absoluteness be? Like, what kind of property could it be that both that it accounts for the ineffability of this object and that it is completely unique, that no other object distinguishes it, no other object instantiates it. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And so one area of discourse, one debate this brings up immediately is the debate about hexieties, because hexieties are supposed to be the properties that uniquely identify a certain object. So that seems to fit the bill. So I zoom into current debates about hexieties, and just to give a sort of brief overview over the debate. Hexieties are, as I said, the properties or characteristics of objects that are supposed to guarantee an object's individuality, even in cases where two objects, for example, are otherwise completely indistinguishable. So there is the famous case of Max Black, where we have a universe that consists only of two solid iron spheres with a specific diameter and with a specific distance between one another.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
And in this scenario, what's interesting is that every possible way of describing one sphere is a way of describing the second sphere as well.
Okay.
So, for example, we can say, well, there is one sphere that is 3 meters away from another sphere.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And whatever I'm going to be able to say about that sphere, about one sphere, I will also be able to say about the other sphere, because they're arranged in a symmetrical way and they have exactly the same qualitative properties. And because they stand, well, and because of the symmetrical arrangement of this universe, they also have the same relational properties. So there really is no way of distinguishing these two objects in a description. And hexieties would be a way of, as it were, solving this puzzle by giving each one of the two spheres a property that distinguishes them, that guarantees that they are numerically distinct. Now, what I argue in my book is that hexieties may actually not have the explanatory force that they purport to have. And this is because in order to be able to distinguish between the hexiety of one sphere and the hexiety of another sphere, the only way to distinguish between them would be to point at the objects instantiating each one of those two hexieties. But in order to be able to point at them, we already have to know that they are individuals. So there is a sort of vicious circularity here in terms of what comes first in our metaphysical setup. So I dismiss hexieties as a viable candidate for explaining the absoluteness property. And then I move on to a different way of perhaps making sense of the notion of an ineffable object, which is, well, perhaps it's an object that doesn't instantiate any properties at all. There is a current debate going on in analytical philosophy about bare particulars.
Right.
Bare particulars are supposed to distinguish the substratum theory from the bundle theory of objects. So the bundle theory is things that an object is uniquely characterized by the sum of the properties it instantiates. And the substratum theorist believes that objects are something over and above the properties instantiated by them. And this over and above are bare particulars. And I basically raised the same worry against bare particulars that I also raise against hexieties, which is that they do not seem to have any explanatory value, because in order to distinguish between them, we already have to presuppose that we're talking about an individual object, but this is precisely what we were supposed to show. So I argue that also bare particulars are not good candidates for ineffable objects. And I conclude that this doesn't leave any viable option, at least as far as I can see, to make sense of the notion of an ineffable object, if it is not a specific property that accounts for the ineffability, and if it is also not the complete absence of any property whatsoever that accounts for the ineffability of an object, then I cannot see what else it might be.
Okay. Let me ask you about explainability. I mean, this just occurred to me now as I was listening to your explanation. Is there a relationship between what is ineffable and what is not explainable? That's kind of a bit of a vague question. But a lot of the objects, let me put it this way. Before, when you introduced the concept in a very general sense, you know, intuitive sense of ineffability, you mentioned special sorts of insight, experiences, and these are very, very clear cases of ineffability. Mm-hmm. A lot of the objects that we've been talking about, you know, the absolute or the hexades or bare particulars or cons noumena, are precisely sorts of things where, they're not explained. They're inaccessible in some way. We can't know them. And so I'm just wondering if maybe there's a sense of ineffability where what's ineffable is something that we can't express it, because we can't get at it. All we can say is it's sort of a known unknown, and as opposed to an experience that we have that gives us insight into something. These seem to be very different and both kind of valid ideas of what, you know, historically perhaps people have gestured at when they're talking about something being ineffable, and that
right.
A lot of the objects seem to be of the latter sort, not where I have, you know, people can have, say, experiences of the divine, you know, some sort of revelation. That's true, and that would be a special sort of insight, as you mentioned. But then there can also be a concept of the divine, of, you know, the one or the absolute or something which is inexpressible because we can't even get there. We can say it's beyond our ken in some way, but both of those seem to be types of ineffability, and it just occurred to me, you know, maybe is there something more to be said about what can or cannot be explained, or what can or cannot be accessed?
I think that's a very interesting question. I think there definitely is a relation between the two concepts. And I think that, well, as a first approximation, what is experienced as ineffable is also often experienced as unexplainable. It leaves us puzzled in a way. We don't really know what happened because we had this experience that, and normally we're able to formulate our experiences, to phrase them. And in this sense, and ineffable experiences, we cannot. and the objects you mentioned, like, are you thinking about something like Kantian things in themselves, for example?
That would be a perfectly fine example. Yeah, you can experience, right. You know, you can have experiences. Well, obviously, you know, we have phenomenal experiences. And those can be ineffable, right? I mean, you know, it before an artwork and so forth. And then we can also, you know, say, well, and there's this other kind of reality, this the noumenal, which we can't access it. And that could also be ineffable, but in a different sort of way.
Yes. Yes. So I think perhaps what distinguishes the case of art, as you just said, and the case of a Kantian thing in itself is that there is a way in which the Kantian thing in itself is a perfectly mundane thing because it, as it were, stands behind every object we have causal contact with, even though Kant would refrain from saying something like this because, as we all know, Kant would not want us to talk about the thing in itself at all. But I think, so to come back to what you mentioned about unexplainability, the thing in itself is what is sort of, it's sort of postulate that we have to assume in order to make sense of our perceptual experiences. But according to Kant, we never experience things in themselves directly. They only ever enter our mind in a mediated way through sense perceptions and through our specific ways of intuiting the world. So in a way it is, well, so the thing in itself has a certain explanatory function, but itself is its existence, and what explains the thing in itself cannot be explained. And this is perhaps something that could be linked up to the ineffability of things in themselves as well. So I think there might be an interesting connection between unexplainability and ineffability as well.
Okay. So after you sort of discussed the ineffable objects, you then set your sights on ineffable propositions or truths. And one of these, for example, you have actually throughout the book, you have these very nice diagrams in which you kind of break things down into their various types and subtypes and so forth. So one of the ineffable truths that you talk about is, for example, the liar paradox. And you also have Tom Nagel's discussion of the experience of a bat, right? What it's like to be a bat. And then Frank Jackson's discussion of the neuroscientist Mary, who grows up in the black and white room and never has an experience of color, right? Right. So could you say something about, you know, your analysis of ineffable truths of these sorts?
Yes. So I'll start with the liar paradox because it's actually not a kind of example that I would have thought of immediately when thinking about ineffability. But whenever I spoke to other philosophers about ineffable propositions, people immediately said, oh yeah, right, the liar paradox. And so I began thinking about it a little bit. And I think the ineffable, well, what relates the liar paradox to ineffability is that we have a situation where we cannot express the truth value of a certain proposition. So the liar paradox is the paradox where we know that a person is a notorious liar, which means that this person will always utter a falsehood, will never say a truth. So let's say this person or this liar utters the sentence, this sentence is false. So then the question is, how should we evaluate this sentence? What truth value does this sentence have? On the one hand, if it says that it is false, then knowing that we're talking to a liar who always says false things, it would be true. But on the other hand, if it was true, then knowing again that we're dealing with a liar, it would be false. So it's unclear what the truth value for this sentence would be. And then there are all kinds of, well, people are really puzzled by the semantic paradoxes. There are also other kinds of semantic paradoxes. And interestingly, they all seem to be related in some way to self-reference, to definitions or setups where self-reference comes into play. And I think that is interesting because of what I'm going to argue, or what I argue at the end of the book about self-knowledge. But this is just a side point. So this is a way of motivating perhaps the notion of an ineffable proposition. We could say that the proposition expressing the truth value of the liar sentence is ineffable. But as I then say in my book, I don't think that this particular example has a lot of metaphysical weight. And I don't think it adds much to the discussion of what we're really interested in, which is how to make sense of the specific ineffable experiences that we encounter in aesthetic and religious and philosophical contexts. So I then move on to very well-known example, Bat and Frank Jackson's Mary. And so here, so the examples are familiar from the debate between physicalists and non-physicalists. The physicalist says that everything there is to know about the world can be expressed in terms of physics. And the non-physicalist says, no, there is more than that. And then we have these examples of what it must be like to be a bat and what it must be like for the neuroscientist Mary to perceive the color red for the first time in her life. And so the debate is over whether or not, over the question whether or not Mary, I'm going to focus on Mary from now on, Mary learns a new fact when she gets out of her room. Mm-hmm. And so, and if we want to say, well, yes, I mean, there is this clear sense in which she learns something new, then the question is, does that get us into ontological trouble? Like, how do we square that kind of fact with all the facts we already know from physics? And so one way of thinking about this is that, or one way that has been suggested is that there are these ineffable perspectival propositions that somehow capture the knowledge that Mary gains, or the knowledge or capture what it is like to be a bat in Thomas Nagel's case. And I then go on to argue that this just doesn't seem to be a very helpful way of setting things up, because as soon as we're talking about facts and corresponding propositions, there will always be the question of how to square those facts with the facts that we already have. And it seems very much like once we admit something like perspectival facts, we're going to run into incoherence, because different perspectives will yield different perspectival facts, which will be mutually exclusive and therefore won't fit into one coherent picture of reality. So I dismiss this way of thinking about ineffable propositions. And I end up arguing, well, I consider a few more cases of ineffable propositions, but I end up arguing that there is no helpful, metaphysically coherent way in which we can make sense of that notion.
Okay. So you also talk about ineffable contents. And one of the cases there is non-conceptual content, right? Which is
right.
A major player in discussions of animal cognition, in particular. Could you say something about non-conceptual contents and their possible ineffability?
Right. So yes. So in my chapter on ineffable content, indeed, my first candidate is non-conceptual content. Concept like very, very hotly debated in philosophy of perception. And so the basic question here is, are all the contents of our mental states conceptual, or are there contents that are not conceptual? And of course, conceptualists argue that all our mental contents are conceptual, and non-conceptualists argue that they are not. And so how would one argue for non-conceptual content? Well, there are certain thought experiments or certain actual facts that seem to suggest that we do have something like non-conceptual content. So, for example, Tim Crane argues that when we look at a waterfall for an extended period of time, let's say for 5 minutes, and then direct our gaze to a static object, then it will seem like that static object is moving upwards. While at the same time, of course, given that it is static, remaining still. So, and this seems to be a case in which we have, well, in which our mental state is characterized by contradictory contents. So, and that might lead us to say, well, we don't want to end up having something like contradictory contents. Maybe we have non-conceptual contents in those cases. Mm-hmm. So then, but I don't find those kinds of examples very convincing, because in order to be able to say that we would have contradictory contents in such cases, we already have to think about it in a conceptual way. So I'm not sure that it gives us what we want. I'm not sure it gives us the kind of non-conceptual content. And perhaps a slightly more intuitive way of thinking about it is that the contents of our perceptual experiences are so rich that it seems almost necessary that they outstrip our conceptual abilities. The perceptual detail of our experiences is so so vast that it seems very counterintuitive to say that we have a concept to express all of these details. That's often referred to as the fineness of grain mm-hmm. of our perceptual experiences. And I think that argument has a lot of intuitive force, but I think on a closer look, we can see why nothing in that argument establishes the existence of a kind of content that is intrinsically ineffable, that is intrinsically non-conceptual. Mm-hmm. And one of the key arguments for that point of view has been made by John McDowell, who argues that we can express whatever kind of perceptual content we want to express by using demonstrative concepts, and perhaps in addition to that, a higher order sortal mm-hmm. to point out exactly what we want to point out. So, for example, there is the question whether or not we can really express every shade of a particular color. And in a way, the answer seems to be no, because we only have a certain range of terms for different shades of blue. On the other hand, though, we can express whatever shade of blue we want to express by pointing at it, by sort of making reference to it in a demonstrative way, and perhaps adding a higher order sort of like blue, and then so that the concept would be that shade of blue. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be, even though that would not be a canonical expression, it would constitute a basis on which we could then go on and form a canonical expression for that particular shade of blue. So I think that the discussion about fine-grainedness and contents of perception in general won't give us a reason to believe in non-conceptual and therefore ineffable contents.
Okay. Well, that's sort of that's a good segue into your final chapters, where you present your own positive account, I suppose, of the things that are ineffable and ineffable. You give four different sorts of knowledge, right? There's ineffable knowledge, in which you include knowing how, logical knowledge, and then indexical knowledge. and phenomenal knowledge.
Right.
So maybe you can say a word about these, and then I'll follow up with this, your core concept of acquaintance and self-acquaintance.
Right. Yes. So in my final two chapters, I talk about ineffable knowledge, and I start off by summarizing what I've said in the previous chapters, which boils down to whenever we try to argue for something like ineffable objects, truths, or contents, we seem to run into some kind of metaphysical incoherence, or on a closer look, the alleged ineffability evaporates. So let's move on to ineffable knowledge. And then the strategy of my argument is to say, all right, we have these cases of ineffable knowledge out there already. I'm talking about four different kinds. And as soon as we've established that, then perhaps it is not as difficult to believe in extraordinary kinds of ineffable knowledge as well. So I start off with the knowledge that, knowledge how debate. Mm-hmm. And I introduce the debate. And the basic question here is there a fundamental difference between knowledge that can be expressed in knowledge that ascriptions? So, for example, I know that it is 7:30 in the evening right now, and other kinds of knowledge that seem to be more difficult to express, that seem to be more something like an ability or a capability or some kind of disposition. So, for example, riding a bike is a classical example, or perhaps playing the violin. Mm-hmm. So is there a meaningful distinction to be drawn between these two? And I think that, yes, very clearly, there is a difference between these two types of knowledge. And the difference is that knowledge that is expressible and communicable, and knowledge how is not. At least only knowledge how is communicable only up to a certain point. And so in my discussion, I focus on an argument by Tim Williamson and Jason Stanley, where they basically argue that every knowledge how ascription can be converted into an equivalent knowledge that ascription. And what I'm arguing is that the problem with such conversions is that it always, the newly formulated knowledge how that comes in knowledge that form will always involve a primitive, which Stanley and Williamson call the mode of presentation M, under which we know how to do X. And what I'm arguing is that everything that is interesting about knowledge how and that distinguishes it from knowledge that is put into that little primitive. So even though it seems like we've managed to convert knowledge how ascriptions into syntactically identical knowledge that descriptions, there is this primitive of the primitive mode of presentation that still contains everything that is mysterious about knowledge how. And intuitively, what is this mysterious thing is that we cannot reveal knowledge how to ride a bike, for example, by purely linguistic means. We cannot fully explain to a person how to ride a bike. Learning how to ride a bike involves a certain process of learning that involves a trial and error and getting into the bike riding business. It cannot be fully spelled out in language. So yes, so I think that knowledge how is an obvious candidate for an ineffable kind of knowledge. And then I move on to discuss basic logical knowledge, and very roughly what I'm doing is I'm looking into a few things, a few remarks by Frege, and just describing what logic actually is. And what he says is that we can only say things and we can only prove things up to a certain point. And this certain point is our logical laws, our logical axioms. And beyond that point, well, there's nothing more to do, not for the philosopher, not for the logician. And what I'm saying is that, well, in order to come up with these logical laws, with our logical axioms. Well, knowing what these are is a type of knowledge. So basic logical knowledge, given that it cannot be expressed in logical formulas anymore, is a second type of ineffable knowledge. And I then move on to indexical knowledge, which is a very interesting kind of knowledge, also hotly debated. And the basic question here is, well, it's not even a question. It's something everyone agrees on. There is a type of knowledge that cannot be expressed in words, which is an indexical knowledge. And the way we can see that this knowledge exists is in cases like the famous supermarket example by John Perry, where he is pushing his supermarket cart around and he sees a trail of sugar on the floor, and he keeps following the trail of sugar and keeps following it. And he forms the thought, somebody in the supermarket is making a mess. And when he sort of, he follows up the end of the trail, of the sugar trail, and eventually he realizes he is the person who has a torn sugar packet in his cart. So he is the person who's making the mess. And that, so that kind of knowledge involved a self-ascription of the property of making a mess. And so what's interesting here is that we could have described the scenario to the person in the supermarket. We could have said, there is a guy in the supermarket who's making a mess, and then this guy is standing here and there, and this guy has blonde hair. But nothing in a full description of the scenario would enable the person to infer that he is the person making the mess. So that it seems to be a special kind of process that is necessary in order for us to realize that a certain property is instantiated by ourselves, like that we are the acting person in a given scenario.
Right. Let me just ask to go back for a moment, because we're starting to run out of time, and I did want to ask about so the knowing how versus knowing that, and this kind of goes back to your definition of ineffability in the beginning, in terms of something being or not being linguistically expressible. And I guess the question is, your paradigm case of knowing that is knowing how, knowing how is knowing how to ride a bike or play a musical instrument or something.
Yes.
And you know, so somebody might say that knowledge, how, is perfectly expressible. I express it just by doing it. I don't need to express it linguistically. And so, in other words, the idea of ineffability isn't just cannot be, say, spoken or cannot be expressed using some sort of language. But there are different ways of expressing, and expressing knowing how by doing something is a perfectly legitimate form of expressibility. And that would mean that sort of knowledge is not ineffable at all. It's just not
right.
It's not ineffable linguistically, but that would just be, you know, why would that matter?
I see. Well, that's a legitimate question. And to a certain extent, restricting expression or my definition of ineffability to linguistic expressions is a purely stipulative matter. And that's because I'm mostly interested in what can be done with language and what cannot. But I think there is also a deeper sense in which calling an action an expression of a particular knowledge how is not helpful. And I think it has to do with the fact that it does not meet the the aspect of communicability, the requirement of communicability. So if you ride a bike in front of me, then perhaps there is a sense in which we could say that you're expressing your knowledge how by riding that bike. But there is no way that you can communicate to me that knowledge. So by looking at you riding a bike, I won't be able to learn how to ride a bike. So I think that's an important point to make in this context. And another thing that might be interesting to mention here is that one reason why I'm so interested in the expressive capacities of language is because language seems to be our most fine-grained means of communication that we have. So some people sometimes tell me, well, an artwork can perhaps express
an emotion.
An emotion, mm-hmm. or can be expressive in some way. And so in that sense, perhaps aesthetic contents, as is often held, are not ineffable at all. And I think that is a perfectly legitimate intuition, and under a different definition of ineffability, that's perfectly true. But there is the problem that we don't really have any clear grasp of what a semantics of artworks would be like, or a semantics of actions, what would constitute a successful case of expression, and in the case of the bike, for example, the aspect of communicability. So mm-hmm. I think it's just our most intuitive way of thinking about ineffability is in terms of linguistic, the non-ability to express something linguistically. And that justifies my focus. But I completely agree with you that this is an arbitrary stipulation, and somebody else might want to think about it in a different way.
Okay. So I think we have one more quick question, and it's really not a quick question, but we're sort of running out of time, but I do want to get to it. Is in your last chapter, you talk about subjectivity playing a central role in meaningful ineffability, and that you explain ineffability in terms of self-acquaintance, right? So there's a relationship of acquaintance, and then also this concept of a self. Can you? I realize this is kind of the what you've been building to, but unfortunately, readers will fortunately have to read the book to get the details. But if you could say a word about this role of self-acquaintance in your account.
Absolutely, with pleasure. So the four kinds of ineffable knowledge I introduce, and specifically indexical knowledge, seem to indicate that there is such a thing as the self, which is required for self-ascriptions, for example, in cases of ineffable knowledge. And my argument is then that we can get acquainted with this entity, which is ourself. And I suggest that this is what's going on in cases of meaningful ineffability. And so there are a lot of claims involved here. And I'm not sure I'm going to have time to go through all of those. But perhaps the most important thing to say is that we do have evidence that this entity called the self must exist, because otherwise things like indexical knowledge don't really make much sense. Mm-hmm. We need the self for these self-ascriptions. And then I discuss also phenomenal knowledge and knowledge by acquaintance. I suggest that it is perfectly legitimate to assume that we can also get acquainted with this self just in just the same way that we can get acquainted with other things and objects out there. What I'm saying is that the fact that we're getting acquainted with ourselves can account for the meaningfulness that is attached to the kinds of meaningful, ineffable experiences that form the subject matter of my book. And this is because ordinarily ourselves are always present. They're always sort of the reference point for all of our experiences. But hardly ever is the self the object of our direct, perception, or perhaps not even perception, of our awareness. So we get acquainted with the self in meaningful moments, and this can explain why we attach importance to such experiences.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah. I didn't mind me to cut you off there. Sorry.
I was just going to add that I realize that the way we've discussed things right now, this might sound like a little bit of an ad hoc idea, and I would need some extra time to run through the entire argument. But it might be for the interested hearer, it might be an indication of where I'm headed in the last chapter of my book.
Okay, very good. Well, I mean, the readers will have to discover that for themselves. But in the meantime, I'd like to end with a question about where you plan to go next philosophically. Are you going to continue along the same path as this book and maybe answer further questions, or are you working on something else entirely?
It's both, really. I'm still very interested in ineffability and trying to refine the concept of ineffability in different contexts. But currently what I'm working on most of the time is analyzing problems that occur, identical problems that occur in different philosophical domains. So, for example, at the moment, I'm writing a paper about the access problem that occurs for mathematical realism, mm-hmm. for moral realism, for realism about modality, realism about logic, et cetera, et cetera. So, as in the case with ineffability, which is a concept that comes up in all kinds of different philosophical contexts, also now I'm dealing with problems that seem to have a sort of cross-domain relevance. I guess that's something I'm specifically interested in that guides my philosophical endeavor.
Yeah. Well, sounds good. I'd be interested in reading that whenever that comes out.
Thank you.
So in the meantime, I appreciate your taking the time to talk with us about your new book.
Thank you very much, Carrie. It was really, really nice talking to you about it. And thank you so much for taking the time to actually get into my book and thinking about it and inviting me to give this interview today. I'm very happy about that.
Very good. So, yeah, thanks again. And good luck with what you're working on still.
Thank you very much. The same to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Sylvia Jonas, Polonsky Postdoctoral Fellow at the Van Leer Institute and visiting researcher at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. We've been talking about her new book, Ineffability and Its Metaphysics, which is just out from Palgrave Macmillan. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.